So if I want to contact you, do you have email?
Yeah, is my email on that?
I don't know.
I'll read it on it at the end. Sean@pprproject.org. Hold on, I'll grab my pen. Yeah, I'll send you that reading list as well.
Oh yeah,
Or
please.
even if you want to send me an email asking about specific,
Yeah.
I'll see if I can point you in the direction of
Yeah.
my Fergal. Amongst the two of us, he's the academic, so he'd be the better. He'd be the one who might be able to.
So you didn't go to university then?
I did. I just didn't stick it out. I wasn't there.
Wasn't for you.
It wasn't my thing. No, I ended up. I mean, I've three kids, and kids young and all too. So, my dad's 14 this year. Well, he was born during all that period of all sorts of things. University didn't happen. I actually wouldn't mind going back at some stage, or
Sure.
and picking something to do, but
Especially related with the work you're doing.
to this stuff,
And
yeah.
actually have the time to kind of think it through
That
in
was
a
part.
research setting, you know?
That was part of what this when what I'm interviewing you about now. We got a myself and Marissa were given a £50,000 grant to do a fellowship to study our stuff,
Yeah.
to think about our stuff and our campaigning on housing through analysing other campaigns in other jurisdictions, particularly post-apartheid South Africa, given our own post-peace
Yes.
situation
Right.
and North America.
Yeah.
So that was it. We went to a whole range of different campaigns. We ended up speaking to a lot of people, you know, Black Lives Matter and all that. They weren't relevant to how, but
Yeah.
campaigning methodologies and
Yeah.
different sort of, we got a conversation with a lot of different people. And that was supposed to be my reflective time, you know what I mean? But to be honest, all I've had the chance to do is harvest all these analyses and
Yeah.
then not sit back and have a think and go, where does that fit? How does ours complement? Is there any use in any of this stuff?
Yeah, yeah,
So I would love to do that. I'd love to take time to sit back and do that.
yeah.
But where do you get time when you're
You got to
trying to
make it
affect, you're
somehow.
trying to affect change?
Yeah, right, sure.
So for this, I was hoping to ask you about the, I'm going to struggle every time to pronounce, but Abathlali.
Yeah.
And basically the principles, tactics, strategies, structure, that to get an understanding of them. I was supposed to
Right.
come and see you in Durban, didn't.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, well, that's fine.
Where are you? You're in Boston now, are you?
Yeah, in Boston, yeah. That's why I teach in Boston. I live in Providence, Rhode Island.
And but you were embedded there for a while. You were in.
I was there. I don't know when we were talking about this exactly, but I was kind of it. Maybe it was a time when I was in and out. I was over in South Africa in March and April this year.
Oh, that would have been it. And how did the connection come about between yourself and
Okay,
Abathlali?
the birth of it was 2005, and the organization as an organization took some time to develop. It basically spontaneously emerged when some land that some one of the shack settlements in Durban called Kennedy Road, which is like about 5,000 people live there. Some land that they were promised, they saw some bulldozers on it, and it was going to be made into something commercial. I don't know what happened to it in the end, but anyway, so they went, and they'd been working with, they'd actually had a kind of democratic structure in the shack settlement. Not all shack settlements are democratic. Some are like run by gangsters
Yeah.
or political, almost like. Almost like the same kind of politics that you see when we were driving around. You know, it could be run by the political party. It could be run by a shack lord. It could be run by gangsters, so forth. Anyway, they had a democratic structure, and so they made a decision to go and occupy the ring road. So they went down and stopped the traffic. You know, I mean, in South Africa, there's. At that time, this is kind of the beginning of, what later became known as service delivery revolt. That is, that people in poor areas would spontaneously revolt because of some lack of services, whatever that was, often about housing or sewage or toilets or water or electricity or whatever wasn't being delivered, right? The idea was the government was supposed to deliver these things. It was very neoliberal in terms of the notions that we sat back and waited and the government would deliver. And Abbas Lali was thought about originally as a kind of service delivery sort of pressure group, but they weren't at all. They really weren't simply about gaining things. It was really about it. It was an autonomous movement. So its birth was this revolt, and I think maybe about 13 people were arrested, and many of them young people. And they had no notion of developing a movement. But the how I got involved was that a close friend of mine who was in Durban at the time went down. He heard about it on the radio and he went down to find out what was going on and talk to the shack dwellers. And they were very, you know, many of them were sort of dismissive. He's a white guy, so they didn't know who he was. And,
yeah.
But he helped them. Initially, I think I might be wrong. He helped them initially with some legal, getting them in touch with like lawyers or something to help people who were arrested. So it was all about kind of providing resources, and so that's how I originally found out about it, because shack dwellers had been there'd been poor people's movements, but you hadn't really heard of anything. From the shacks, they were sort of like the other people who were sort of outside of civil society, and you never really heard. And also the idea was that they were completely like this controlled by the ANC, so there was no sort of voice, you know, from the shack settlements. So then they had a following that was a big demonstration, all word of mouth. I mean, basically they had no resources, no money, right? I mean, the poor people, but they created in the settlements, they made banners and all sorts of things. And I think about 5,000 people went on this demonstration in Durban. It was essentially the first kind of demonstration like this. And it was really connected between two major settlements, the Kennedy Road settlement and the one quite near to it called Foreman Road settlement. And Kennedy Road is actually in a area which is right down the bottom of this essentially Indian, because in terms of post-apartheid South Africa, you know, obviously everything was separated, yeah. vis-a-vis apartheid rules. And so you had the kind of the Africans were not allowed to be in the cities unless they had work. If they didn't have work, then they have to be moved out of the city. But the second-class citizens were the so-called colours, yeah, and Indian population. So anyway, there was this sort of middle-class Indian residential area. And at the bottom of that, there was a sort of industrial area. And between those, and there was a this big dump, one of the biggest sort of dumps or garbage sites in South Africa. And the shack settlement was right there, kind of like in the spaces, yeah, that you could find, and it'd been there for, you know, maybe 30 years, not maybe in the size that it had become, but it had grown up during the struggle, really, as the pass laws, I think, were abandoned in 86. There was an enormous amount of pressure, and it became sort of the capacity of the state could no longer police the pass laws.
Yeah.
And so they abandoned the pass laws, which meant that it kind of, there was already a lot of migration from rural areas and into the urban areas. And this was in the context of some of the uprising against apartheid, it became impossible to sort of police this. So in this period from the mid 80s or even earlier than that until, until the end of apartheid in 94, there was growing migration and increasing number of shack settlements, which were seen by, viewed by the social movements as, important as part of the anti-apartheid struggle. And the other thing you have to understand about anti-apartheid, although the ANC was the party, they were really an external party, and what was inside was broad democratic groups like the United Democratic Front, the UDF, which allied with the ANC, but not everyone did, right? But they were sort of broader
than that.
Anyway, after about 6 months, I think this happened in March, and then maybe in November of that year, or October of 2005, they had contacted about 30 communities, something like that, to build an organization called Abbas Lali. And the idea of it would be that it would be completely autonomous to each individual shack settlement, but based on certain principles about open, about democracy.
And see, even some of that stuff, did it understand that structurally? How would that work? How would that democratic structure? How would that work?
It would work through, there'd be basically weekly meetings where each settlement would either take...
How's it going?
Good, where are you?
Enjoy the time?
Yeah. would take, there'd be representatives from each settlement coming to like a meeting in this room, right? So you'd get 30 people sitting in a room like this, and then there'd be a 3 or 4 hour meeting. And also there'd be meetings, it would also work around meetings in the evening, because you'd have people working. So the idea would be that each settlement itself would be meeting. And then there'd be these weekly meetings of all the settlements. Delegates or anyone who'd want to come. It wasn't necessarily delegates. It was totally open, but obviously as many people who could come would come. And then there'd be, on top of that, different kinds of events and so forth, so everyone would be involved. And the communication within or between all the shack settlements.
And were the events like the whole social end of the thing as well, or yeah?
There are definitely social events, but activities like which would be held in the office where, for example, when the Slums Act, when KwaZulu-Natal were going to bring in the Slums Act, and it basically would mean the eviction of people, it would become the legal eviction of people from the settlements in terms of a kind of removal of slums. They got together and read the bill line by line to understand what was going on. So it's a lot about education in terms of their own kind of thinking through how is this going to affect us, and having with the principle that that there was no sort of like line or anything being promoted. It was like through the discussion that we decide what to do, not that I come in with an idea of what we should do and then discuss that. It's very much kind of up from the ground.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get at. I mean, some of that stuff, I mean, even the stuff that came up around Occupy, although very probably more middle class and all that type of stuff, but those structural, that open horizontalist structure that people try to implement, I think maybe retarded decision making too in some senses, but. Yeah. How does decision making happen? How does a priority get picked? And how do Abbas Lali move on an issue using that format?
Yeah, I mean it can take time, but it's also incredibly efficient. Obviously, they are responding a lot of the times to stuff that happens. So, for example, there was a demonstration, I think, in the end of June, in Durban, and this really comes up out of the meetings. They discuss, for example, so they're involved continually in fighting evictions or defending or part of the defense of communities. I mean, it's interesting, community shack settlements join because Abbas Lali is seen as an organization that will help them fight evictions.
Yeah.
So
have immediate utility, like, yeah.
So they don't necessarily, and a shack settlement only has to agree to the principles, the democratic principles, to be part of it.
So they have a constitution of sorts, or a...
There is a constitution, although I don't know where. I'm sure it's available. There was a constitution. This is interesting, actually. There was a constitution developed maybe about 10 years ago that I remember seeing. But it's not like something that is...
dogmatic thing? Or...
Yeah, it's not. It's really about the constant kind of communication and not so much about writing material, although they have an internet, a website, they have Facebook page, they have other kind, you know, they probably have a Twitter thing,
yeah.
So forth. I mean, they have a you know, internet presence.
But the primary thing seems to be about the relationships, the actual real human relationships between people. Yeah,
right. And so the you know, there are elections and people are elected to positions. I mean, they have you know, like a, they have a formal structure.
Yeah.
They have a president. They have, you know, office workers and general secretary or something, and women's league president, youth league president,
okay,
and all these things. But they don't meet as an executive. That executive doesn't meet separate from the membership meeting.
Yeah,
it's not as though, okay, we elected you, now you get on and make the decisions. They are often, they might come to a meeting, and I've heard Spusa Kodi, who's the president, who was the founder, one of the founders from the beginning, say that, you know, I mean, he's challenged by the youth, for example, that they've decided on something. For example, interesting, this is a very, very interesting example, and it caused a lot of dissension amongst the left, because after they were attacked, this is in the book actually, they were attacked in 2009. There was two things. One, they were able to, they took the Slums Act to constitutional court. They have alliances, not alliances, but they have help from like SERI, which is a SERI
strategic litigation type.
Yeah, so they got like legal advice and so forth, legal representation for free at the Constitutional Court, and they won this case against the Slums Act. And then a few days after that, Kennedy Road, where their office was and where many of their members were, was attacked, violently attacked by a you know, like 20 or 30 men with guns and also clubs and so forth, and people attacked, and it was a pogrom, basically. People, you know, Abbas Lali was forced out, all the members were just forced out.
Whose behest was that?
That was essentially the behest of the ANC, ANC councillor, who wanted to control the, yeah, because controlling a shack settlement means controlling resources, whatever shack, you know, if there's any housing coming down the pipeline, rather than a democratic committee just, you know, making a list and making sure everyone gets housing. If the ANC run it, then I can give it to my family, who I know. It's a patronage system. So it's really about, you know, it's really about resources. Anyway, after that process, which were, you know, incredible amount of violence, and also meant that for a while they were on the run and hiding. There was death threats against them, against the leadership and other people. The next election, there was a decision about, well, who we can't. Their position had always been no vote, no house, no land, no vote. In other words, rather than being a vote bank, they'd always been seen as a vote bank. So the ANC would come in before an election and would bring biryani. It's Durban. It's a very Indian area, an Indian cuisine. It's very popular in African, in the whole area. So they'd bring like a pot of biryani in, and everyone would have rice and chicken. And then the idea was, oh, that you're going to vote ANC, right? And so they broke with that and said they wouldn't vote. So they wouldn't, not that they'd vote for somebody else, they just wouldn't vote unless they got, land and house. So they had a kind of boycott position. And then after these attacks, they pragmatically said, well, who's going to defend us if we get attacked? We have to be able to talk to someone. So they had, I can't remember what year this was, but anyway, they had the political parties, not the ANC, come talk with them. And the DA, which is the party that runs Cape Town, right? They decided that they would vote DA. Abaslawi decided they would vote DA, who would be essentially in opposition. I mean, basically, Durban is totally ANC.
Yeah.
So DA would never win anyway, but they would be, and they made, the DA made promises about there would be, we'd protect you, and, we'd make a voice, So in other words, if something happened, they could actually get into the media quickly and tell people something happened, because anyway, the long and short of it was the DA didn't help them at all.
Yeah.
But it's also a learning experience that, again, we've been betrayed, but you can imagine the left were like, well, how can you vote for the DA? For them, the ANC are the oppressor.
Yeah.
The DA, yes, they've got no illusions in the DA's politics, but they wanted someone to be able to stand up for them to the mayor or to power to represent them,
yeah.
To protect them when they were under this incredible violence. So you can see that. But the interesting, why I mentioned this was that this was never something that this decision was made. And it was very difficult because people were saying, just spoof the coding, like, well, how could you decide? How did you do that? And the point is that it was a democratic vote. It's what people decided.
Yeah.
So he totally disagreed with it. And he'd even say now that it was a mistake.
Yeah.
But so in other words, there's not like it is based on discussion and also there was discussions at all the settlements, and there was a long process of thinking through, what decision to make.
And how about, so as a tactic, obviously they decided, let's tactically vote for the DA.
Yeah.
One, as a defensive measure, but maybe also as a bloody nose to the ANC.
Yeah.
How do those tactical decisions get made, and the level of, when I was in South Africa, there was everything going on from kids burning principals' cars outside schools, black cops stopping black kids getting into Stellenbosch University, all of the whole gambit of things going on in Khayelitsha and Mitchell's Plain and Langa and NGOs and protest and more direct actions, and how did Abathrali make a call, particularly if it's vulnerable people or it's families, or it's, how do they make the tactical calls and how far do they go, or how, give me a sense of that. Like, I'm assuming if people are dying, those are things that have to be considered by families before making a move. We wouldn't have anywhere close to that as a fear here, although there are some fears, like the paramilitary stuff and all, there are threats and all of that. But I don't think we would have close to that type of level of...
Yeah.
We would have to be worried about decisions that much. So how do they make those calls? What tactics do they deploy, and how do they make the calls?
Yeah, like I said yesterday, when the mayor said there was going to be a new relationship with the poor and would include Abaslawi in decisions and so forth, they took that. They have learned not to trust politicians, but they also were open. They were open to that. In other words, so that's very tactical, right? They said, okay, let's see what happens. We'll come along to meetings, and they went along to meetings with the mayor.
So they don't have a principal non-engagement?
Exactly. Not a principal boycott position at all. And what they do is they make sure that if we were meeting in this room and you were the mayor, they'd have like five or six people come in, not just one or two. You know, in other words, or 10. You know, they want to make sure that no one's representing, because they know that individuals can always be, you know, they can always be bought off, and people have been, you know, that's the experience. People are in desperate situations, so if they're offered a job or a house or something, that could be the end of.
Yeah, do you lose them?
So they did meet with the mayor, but they're not. But then, you know, the experience was that the evictions continued, and in fact, continued at a pace. In other words, they were then fighting evictions at different locations around the city. Local Abertholi were fighting, or just essentially being evicted and then going back in to rebuild the shacks. And that's when the violence upped in the last 6 months. Some, you know, they bring in private security guards. There was shooting, and a stray bullet hit a baby who was killed, and then a man was killed in another place. But they know, they've learned that all these evictions are illegal, so they try to get an interdict from the court, but they also know that you have to also be in situ. In other words, you have to still be in the place, because you could say the thing was illegal, but if it's done, it's done. So they go back in, and for the people in those situations, basically, there's no choice to a degree, right? In other words, that's where you're living, and your stuff's in that place, and it's getting burnt and so forth. Where are you going to go? The city aren't going to provide you anywhere. So you have to go back, and you need the strength of community. You need, in other words, the idea is that solidarity is built by numbers. You need those numbers behind you to protect your particular, and it has to be social. Individually, you're weak.
And do they, I mean, over 10 years, are you saying, or more, of Abertholi? I'm sure they have.
Five, yeah, 12 years, yeah.
I'm sure they have all the ebb and flow of, you know, killing activists, losing activists, you know, everything that comes in between.
Yeah.
How is it that they sustain them? I'm assuming there are victories. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm assuming there are at least small steps in progress to keep people motivated. Yeah. How is it that they keep motivated over 10 years?
I mean, it's a great question. And there's this film that you can probably see online. And if not, maybe the organization can buy it, because I think it would be interesting to show it. It's called Dear Mandela. And it was a film made about Abertholi, I think maybe about 5 years ago, and it won a number of prizes in it. And it focuses on some Abertholi militants, three Abertholi militants, young people. One of them, Nikelo, was a very, very strong militant with the organization for a long time. And you'd never think he would have left the organization, but he did. And a lot of it was difficult. You'd get different stories about it, but I think it had also to do with family pressure, because he wasn't really earning any money. And although he, for example, got fame through this film,
real life kicked in
vis-a-vis, you know, what about family and what about, you know, so forth. And so he left. And another young man in the film, I've forgotten his name, who's still with Abertholi, but in the meantime, between the film and now, has got addicted to drugs, you know, stole money, got clean, got re-addicted. So two different stories of people that were militants, and if you saw the film, would think, you know, you know, these people
be their labors, yeah.
But individual situations, and then other people who have who were there at the founding, who were able to get houses, so they didn't, you know, in other words, able to get resources out of
them. And that their situations fixed. I mean, we have that. We've had 300 people who need houses come through the campaign the last 2 years, and how many have we got as activists?
Right.
8, 9, 10 drivers at any given one time, you know.
Right.
That's the people piggyback on the campaign, get a resource, and
exactly.
That's it. Or some who'd never get a win are your most resilient, because where else are they going to go, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And that also translates, because as I said, settlements join because Aberthlawi's been seen to be a viable organization that can help against eviction.
Yeah.
So it's like a trade union. You join that. It doesn't mean that you're going to be there, that you're going to even necessarily buy into all the principles.
Yeah.
Because the principles are a lot deeper than that. But
how long ago did the Cape Town branch start? Because that came out of another thing too, right? That came out of what's his name's thing. There was the Cape Town like anti-eviction.
Yeah, the anti-eviction camp, the Western Cape anti-eviction campaign was allied to Aberthlawi for a while.
And then Aberthlawi has its own Cape Town thing, right?
There's that one branch in that area, which is way, I can't even remember where it is now. It's a ways away.
Is it in Khayelitsha or?
I think it's
just playing. Yeah.
Might be. It was a long way away from Cape Town.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one interesting thing too. It's had these national connections, but often, but not often, but some of the contradictions that one can imagine vis-a-vis personalities and mass movements, and when mass movements are no longer mass, but like, you know, based around individuals.
Yeah. And maybe structure. I mean, structures being maintained just for the purpose of structures and all of that type of stuff. I mean,
and so if you're further away from Durban, where these meetings are constant, and you're kind of on your own in another location, they've just withered, died off. They've grown, they've come about. But to maintain a viable activist base like the numbers, you know, it's difficult. For example, last year, well, earlier in March or April, I was in just outside Johannesburg. We went to see a group who were trying to get control of the land they were on. And they'd contact Aberthlawi, and they wanted Richard, who's this guy who was originally in Durban, now he's actually in Johannesburg. So I went with him up there, and it was a completely, you know, it's a very different situation than the Durban situation in terms of local politics. But they had, you know, it's probably about 30 or 40 people in the room, but you never know how, you know. It's isolated up in Johannesburg.
Yeah.
So the question is, it really depends on them. They have to. Aberthlawi don't really bring that many resources, and they also say, well, you have to do it.
Yeah. So they've got some key lessons, or
they can tell you about their experiences, and they can give you advice about stuff, and they have lots of contacts in, you know, lawyers and human rights people and media and so forth.
So they pass on a lot of tools, contacts and all that, but it has to be organic then. It has to be organic,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I mean, I think there's and conscious of your time and all here, right, too.
No, it's fine.
But
yeah.
In all of the places that I went, right, there's this obvious Fenian stuff and everything else. There is this obvious lack of a reconciliation with colonial past, right? Whether it's slavery in America, apartheid in South Africa, here with our divisions around politics and religious. And to me, it seems like in all three places, in all three locales, there's just a clear lack of a reconciliation and with the past. with apartheid South Africa, white money seemed to stay the same. You know, definitely in Cape Town, as I've witnessed it, white money stayed the same. Therefore, resources didn't move, and that was the case in America. White money usually stayed the same, and that's been the case here. The unionist dominance has stayed the same, and resources have stayed the same. So what do you think? I mean, now, 20 years into a post-apartheid, with everybody, with a legacy of struggle behind and a new generation coming up, realising that that was a distant past for them, What do you think the future holds for, I mean, what steps need to be taken to make that real reconciliation? Will the economics differ? Will the resources actually come to the people who've been dispossessed of them in the first place? I know it's a mad one. Like, if you predict that one, if you come up with that answer, I'll start selling it to the world.
Yeah, no problem. But I mean, it's interesting. I was having breakfast with in 2011 or 12 with Spusa Kode and Bishop of Durban, Bishop Rubin. Bishop Rubin had actually been the vice, when Steve Biko was the president of SASO, Rubin was the vice president. So he'd come out of the Black Consciousness tradition. And he had been a real believer in Abbas Lali. And he put his voice, you know, during the really dark days. He was one person that was really, it was tremendous, you know, to have someone that powerful, that respected.
Yeah. A validation,
And Rubin asks Sokodi, "Well, is it race or is it class?" And Sokodi said, "It's about class," and Rubin said, "It's about race." So it's actually fascinating because for Abbas Lali, they don't really have any contact with whites. It's black police, black security guards, black people shooting at them, black mayor, black local councillors, you know, black mafia, you know, or black builders of shitty housing, black, because of the whole black economic empowerment was about, you know, tenders to housing developers. So if you were African, you'd be able to get that state tender to build those houses. And of course then it was, well, how can I do it on the cheap so I can get as much money pocket, you know, they only get like R100,000 or something for per house, so then, you know, how crappily can I build this house so it looks like a house, but you know, so, you know, on one hand you're absolutely right, when you're in Cape Town is incredibly racially divided. I mean, it's just amazing, because you go to a certain class of space in the city, and it's a white space, it's, the city is much more deracialized than other cities like Johannesburg or Durban. If you get to Durban, you know, one success of apartheid, I don't want to say, you know, it was all total waste of time. One success is that if you go to the seafront, which is wonderful kind of urban space, which is available to everyone, you know, it's a majority Indian and African space. Anyone's there, but and it's multi-classed as well. It's not like only, you know, you can get, like, people can take a combi there, and you can go and, like, you know, go to the beach and hang out and so forth. And Durban downtown itself is essentially been Africanized. Whites are now frightened to go down to Durban downtown, and the same with areas of Johannesburg, which are considered incredibly violent and so forth. So, but anyway, so it's not, it's about capital rather than simply white capital. You know, Cyril Ramaphosa was on the board of Lonmin Miner, you know, Lonmin Corporation. And played a role in the Marikana massacre.
Yeah.
So although yes, that's a white company, you know, that's old, that's Lonro, the old Lonro company, London Rhodesia Mining. definitely has roots in apartheid and so forth. There is a significant connection between capital and the state, and the state run by the ANC. The ANC aren't simply, you know, puppets of white capital.
Okay. What are you going to do about that?
Well, I mean, I think it's the same as here. I mean, it's like last night when I mentioned On Freedom Day, which is an amazing concept, right? And this is why I think that Abathalia, you know, like it does indicate, and you've probably done this, you've probably experienced this yourself with working with some of the women or some of the people in that housing, in the flats or whatever. You know, they're very politically astute. You know, they think, they rethink, and when they get a chance to articulate and talk, they've got lots of ideas. So the whole idea of unfreedom was incredibly pregnant. And so when they, I don't know whether there's a celebration here of, you know, the Good Friday Agreement, everyone puts their flags out, perhaps not, you know, because it's seen as so contested. But there, you know, it's seen as a great day for the ANC, and, you know, we won, and people make speeches at football grounds and so forth. And Abathalia's talk about, well, how can we talk about freedom when we don't, you know, when we don't have it. So it gets back to the original notions of what the struggle was about. It's not about liberating capital from apartheid. It's about, and it's not necessarily about, you know, some abstract idea of socialism. It was about housing for all, education for all, controlling the land, you know, including every, you know, the majority of people who've been excluded, who've been systematically excluded, similar to here, right? Making sure that, and expanding human rights to many new areas, yeah. You know. So it was about education, it's about, you know, freedom not to access education, but freedom to have education is a human right. Freedom to have a house is a human right, not to access it and be able to pay for one, but to have one. Freedom, you know, all those freedoms, right? It would mean a very different kind of political economy to be able to do all that, and different kind of emphases over what are we trying to do. It wouldn't be the result of, well, we have to, you know, grow the economy first and then we can't afford it or something. Yeah. No.
No. Okay. Well, I'm interrogated you enough, and maybe I'll get to Durban sometime in November.
I hope so.
I think I'll have to.
Yeah, it'd be great.
It'd be a definite. Maybe even have a tag a few days on to the end of that thing, yeah. And do two nights maybe or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because Cape Town seemed to be a warped perspective as well of what South Africa is too.
All the cities are very different, but Cape Town, I mean, it's also a sleepy kind of town as well. It's very different. Joburg is very vibrant.
Yeah.
But Durban has its own kind of, it's a very kind of Indian culture. It's the Indian Ocean, different kind of environment, different space.
Yeah.
Obviously in different history. I mean, Cape Town's a very nice tourist place, but it's odd in a way. There are some very interesting, I mean, there's some incredibly interesting activists and intellectuals in Cape Town. But as a space, as a city, it seems more alienating than.
Yeah, well, the city's divorced from all of that. I mean, everybody from Kyleach and Mitchell's Plain, Langa, who move in like so many million ants every day to service the city and then leave it again. I mean, that's what the city is.
Yeah.
From my perspective, anyway, it was just a city serviced by people living 30 miles away from it.
Yeah.
Or further away.
And everyone else is sort of basically majority, majority white, but it becomes very white. And yeah. Then you also have And the other weird thing that I remember from being there and obviously figured it out is District 6, which was completely knocked down. And there's nothing there. So you just have this empty space in the middle of a city.
That's why I think some of that stuff I was saying, but I don't know if you know much of them or if they have a connection with Abu Dhabi or if organizations just don't connect, but that Reclaim the City campaign where they're now occupying land in central Cape Town, families from, you know, Kyalicha and families from Bromwell Street, occupying land that is public land that the government are trying to sell for private development and saying, no, this is the space. I mean, I think they're crucial. The connections between us and that in terms of the land that's available, I think are crucial. And it seems that Abbas Lally are in the same boat.
Yeah.
That land, us people build the homes. Let's get us onto it.
Yeah, exactly.
Those fights for space and land and even Jersey City, you know, families, black, Latino families being pushed out through gentrification by Goldman Sachs and the lawyers moving across the river or up southy or easty in Boston where the same effect, the gentrification effect, pushing out the poorer families.
Yeah.
It really is. I mean, it's a form of pushing capital colonialism out again, it just seems like very similar battles and everything, and really interesting to know all the different diverse activism emerging to challenge it, and the resistance movements that are inspiring stuff. Right, we'll get you up the road here, will we? To back up to that. Thank you very much for that.
Yes,